Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Max.
Hello and welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday. I'm Jeremy Maggs with 30 minutes on South African and global news. We are live and then up as a podcast. Interviews with key business and political figures, prominent newsmakers and leading experts, all in a concise and informative update. It's Wednesday, the 10th of July. Coming up on the programme, the Cape battered by damaging storms. I've got a top climatologist on standby. Why kidnappings are increasing in South Africa. Can the country's auto industry recover in the short term? And the growing popularity of adventure tourism. Another kidnapped businessman has been rescued in Johannesburg, and he is the second to be rescued this week, the 13th since the start of the year. A similar pattern is being observed in the Eastern Cape. So what's the problem? Brigadier Athlende Mate speaks for the South African Police Service and joins me first up on the program. And Brigadier, first of all then, what factors do you believe are contributing to this rise in kidnappings, particularly of businessmen here in Johannesburg and in the Eastern Cape?
Let me firstly put it into context that the rise in kidnappings that we see are kidnappings that are linked to other crimes, such as murder, rape, hijacking. So the motive is not really kidnapping, but for the perpetrators to be able to execute what they want to achieve, they would have to kidnap the victim. So yes, in terms of that, we do see a rise where another common law crime is the motive. But now when we look at and zoom into kidnappings where ransom demands are being made, we strongly believe that as the SAPS, we have been able to stabilize that type of crime. In the third quarter, we saw 138 cases, that is October, between October and December, being reported to the SAPS. And in the previous quarter, we saw, we reported and registered 136 cases. So it was a slight increase, and that's what we're saying. We've been able to stabilize this type of crime. We do believe that we've been able to intercept these syndicates in the last 2 years, talking about 250 arrests being made. But coming back to your question as to why do we see a rise, we are seeing criminals move away from the serious and more violent crimes, and they are seeing these kidnappings for ransom as a quick cash solution because they believe that it's an easier form of way of making money. You kidnap someone, you demand a ransom, you get the ransom, you release. But we are quite confident that as the SAPS, we are able to intercept and dislodge these syndicates with the number of people arrested. And the fact that we have been able to rescue so many businessmen and kids, children from wealthy families without ransom payments being made to these perpetrators, which gives us an indication that we do have the expertise, we do have the capabilities, and the SAPS is competent to investigate and intercept these syndicates.
Nonetheless, this is very concerning. Do you have a sense, Brigadier, of the primary targets of these kidnappings? In other words, is there a specific profile that victims typically fit, nationality, occupation, or any other characteristics?
Look, there is no doubt that these kidnappings, they are well coordinated, well planned. And that is why at the center of our task teams and at the center of investigations is crime intelligence and counterintelligence. All our investigations and all our tracing operations, they're crime intelligence driven, because we do believe that a lot of planning comes from, is as a result of these kidnappings. So they don't just identify someone. They go for wealthy business people. So they do their homework and then they study a person and then they go for it. But we are also investigating within the circle of these wealthy businessmen, if they are inside jobs, who is giving these syndicates information on the wealth, amount of wealth that these business people are having. Because even if you look at the children that were kidnapped, it's not just a child that you find on the streets and whatever. They are children from wealthy business families and so on. So our intelligence is broadening, and we are focusing our efforts on ensuring that within the circles there is no one giving these syndicates information. But most importantly is that communities really need to also play an active citizenry role. When suspicious activities in their communities, you know of a person who is driving fancy cars, but you cannot associate them with a proper business or them going to work and so on. So report that information, and you may remain anonymous, and bring it to our attention so that we work on that information. I always say to communities, intelligence is information from communities. Actually, the majority of our successes are as a result of tip-offs from communities, because they hold the intelligence. They become our witnesses in court, and they are our eyes and ears on the ground.
Brigadier, once you have that intelligence that you refer to, how then would the South African Police Service and the Special Task Force approach an investigation, and for that matter, a rescue operation?
We are very sensitive when it comes to issues of kidnappings. You would have seen that when we are dealing with a kidnapping case, we don't just communicate on it. So once we have the case and the case is reported, you'll not hear from the police. We don't discuss it in the media space because we don't want to jeopardize the life. So such cases are treated with sensitivity, but also that's where we mobilize maximum resources, because our focus is to get the victim safe, unharmed, and alive. So rescuing victims is a priority for us, and that is our main focus. So we are very sensitive to such cases. We hardly communicate on them. We will only communicate once there is a success and we are sure that the victim is safely reunited with their family. So a lot of planning goes to that, a lot of resources, manpower, and we ensure that the highly skilled, highly trained members are deployed. And like I've assured South Africans in the past week to say, we have the necessary capabilities. We've got trained, highly competent hostage negotiators within the SAPS that know how to tackle such situations. And that's why we are urging communities. If a relative, a friend, or any other person gets to be a victim and people start calling you demanding ransom, immediately report it to the SAPS. We know how to handle such cases, because once you start negotiating with these perpetrators, it is not always that you will find your relative or your friend alive once you pay the ransom.
Brigadier, just finally, if I can interrupt, and a quick answer if you don't mind. Given the significant number of kidnappers arrested in recent months, what information have you been able to gather about these syndicates or networks?
Look, we know that some of them, it's their daily bread. They are well coordinated. They are working with other criminals from other countries. And that's why we have the cross-border operations. We've got joint action plans with countries like your Mozambique and other SADC countries. But we are also seeing a lot of copycat groupings that, like I've indicated, I'm doing this as a quick cash solution. You kidnap, you demand, and then you release. But we are treating every case as a priority because we want to save more lives.
Thank you very much for talking to me today, Brigadier Athlende Mate, who speaks for the South African Police Service.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, there's no question that South Africa's car market is under intense pressure. Depressed sales and exports also taking a knock. So I want to look at broad recovery trends in the industry with Michael Mabasa, who is Chief Executive Officer of the auto industry body, NAMSA. And first of all, Mike, and a very warm welcome to you. How is consumer behavior and preference shifting in response to this current economic climate that we are currently dealing with and the pressures on the auto industry?
Well, I think the current economic climate in South Africa has obviously contributed significantly to the consumer behavior that we've seen, particularly in the last 18 months. I think the number of interest rates hikes we've seen has obviously impacted very directly, because you'd recall, Jeremy, that buying a car for many South Africans today is, particularly a brand new vehicle, it's actually the second biggest investment that a lot of consumers make, particularly because of the price points many of the vehicles that we have in the country are currently sold at. And for them to be able to consider buying that particular vehicle, they obviously have to look at their disposable income and their ability to be able to take on new credit and so on. And I think the current economic climate has had a very, very huge impact in that particular consumer behavior that has impacted, unfortunately, negatively our new vehicle sales.
And there is no indication that that is going to change unless we see some sort of movement in interest rates.
Absolutely. So there are two, obviously, very, very important aspects. The first one is the interest rates, and we are hopeful that the the governor of the Reserve Bank will obviously look at cutting season so that we can really be able to give these consumers that particular relief so that they can be able to increase their disposable income. But also companies, I think as we move into the second quarter of the second half of this year, a lot of companies obviously tend to increase salaries in certain areas, which will also be helpful for many consumers because they will now be able to take home a little more than they did as the year started. Mm-hmm. And I think also the fact that from a political front, the political dust has settled. We now have a government of national unity. And I think there's also that, political certainty, from a policy point of view that, South Africa is obviously now beginning to gather itself and be able to move forward in terms of economy recovery programs that will help us to bring back the economy to the levels that we are expecting.
And what specific policy changes are you hoping for that will impact the vehicle market?
Well, look, I think from a vehicle market side, we're obviously looking at how best we can be able to stimulate demand for new vehicles in South Africa, because we're working obviously very closely with government. I'm sure that you are aware that in South Africa, in order for you to be able to buy a brand new vehicle, tax is a very, very important aspect. In buying a brand new vehicle, 42% of that particular price of a brand new vehicle goes into taxation. 42%. So if you are buying a vehicle of 200,000, 84,000 rands of that amount goes into government as a form of taxation. And we are currently engaging government so that we can be able to see how best we can be able to look at things like ad valorem tax, which has not been reconfigured in the last 30 years since the dawn of democracy in South Africa. And we really want to be able to start having those conversations from a policy point of view to say, how do we begin to reduce this burden that consumers have so that that particular 42% can be dropped significantly and that benefit can accrue back to consumers so that they can be able to start buying brand new vehicles in the country.
And what is the trajectory outlook if you don't get those type of breaks?
Well, obviously, it's going to be very, very difficult because certainly a lot of people are going to, instead of opting to buy brand new vehicles, they are going to continue to opt for second-hand vehicles, which has been the trend in South Africa in the last 24 months, where we are beginning to see a lot of consumers, instead of them committing to a brand new vehicles, they tend to go into second-hand vehicles. We've also seen, since COVID-19, a lot of families who used to own 2-3 vehicles in their garages, they've actually traded down where they've either sold one of those 3 vehicles because they are no longer traveling as often as they used to, because many of them are now doing virtual calls and they are able to work from home and they are now relying on one vehicle for the whole family and so on. So we want to see that trend coming back so that we can really be able to make sure that we're able to stimulate demand, because we do have companies in this country who are producing vehicles and we want them to continue to produce vehicles, not only for our export market, but also for local consumers, because we want South Africans also to make sure that we are able to move them to buying also locally produced vehicles that we are producing proudly from our manufacturing plants here in the country.
Are we getting to some form of nexus point where the auto manufacturers, and I'm assuming that you talk to them all the time, are now saying to you, maybe we need to consider scaling down our operation in one way or another?
Well, look, I think that conversation is definitely taking place. It has been taking place since COVID-19. The nice thing with the manufacturers that we have in the country, Many of them are absolutely committed to South Africa. They've indicated that they have no intentions of packing their bags and leaving the country, which is a very, very good sign. And we will continue to obviously speak to them so that they can be able to also continue to invest. Because as you may have noticed, Jeremy, in the last 18 months in particular, all the seven OEMs have announced major investments in the country in terms of recalibrating their lines, because we are now also having conversations with them so that they can be able to accelerate their production plans from internal combustion engine vehicles that we're currently producing into new energy vehicles, because that's where the world is moving. And we want them as well, because South Africa is an export-led market. We don't want to be left behind. We want to make sure that we are able to respond very, very quickly to this global demand for new energy vehicles across the world. So we are certainly working with them, and they are currently absolutely committed to stay in South Africa and continue to invest.
Michael Mabasa, Chief Executive Officer at NAMSA, thank you very much indeed.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, Cape Town continues to be battered by high winds and rain. Thousands of people have been displaced and damage is still being calculated. I want to give you a broader view now on cause and effect, and I'm joined by Professor Guy Midgley from the School of Climate Studies at Stellenbosch University. He has been on the program before. Guy, very warm welcome. Are there any new factors then that are contributing to this extreme weather that we're witnessing?
Yeah, thanks very much for having me. Well, in a way, no. This is sort of standard winter in the Cape in many ways. But what is a little bit unusual is that in the past few weeks, we've had unusually warm conditions and a late autumn and a warm autumn. So I think the sudden descent into icy winter has come as a bit more of a shock than normal. The other unusual aspect, though, is wind speed and damage from wind, which is something that, you know, is starting to raise its head. But it's still early days in understanding exactly what those trends are and how to interpret this new trend.
If you've seen some of the visuals of that wind, it really is quite not only astonishing but terrifying as well. Care to speculate on that as to why we might be seeing an increase?
Well, a couple of things. Obviously, as the ocean temperature warms and the atmospheric temperature rises, there's more energy in the atmosphere, and that can generate steeper pressure gradients and create more extreme wind conditions. But it also relates to the broader patterns, weather patterns, and the arrangement of frontal systems, and how much we're exposed to the high wind conditions that may normally have been a little bit further south off the coast. So a combination of these factors, and this is something which traditional weather monitoring did not monitor in the earliest days. So it was really temperature and rainfall that was monitored regularly. So we have shorter records of wind speed, and that makes the long-term trends more difficult to understand.
Guy Midgley, is the data getting better in terms of early warning systems and how they can be utilized and even improved?
Massively so. Even despite the fact that our monitoring stations by the weather services has dropped, the automation of weather stations and the international network of weather stations, and then the modeling capacities, the sort of short-term ability to model and fill in the gaps, so to speak, between weather stations has improved enormously. And this is one reason why linking one's weather system and weather reporting into the international system add so much value. So it can double or triple the return on investment if your system is well integrated with the international system, and that allows the experts to make far better predictions and forecasts and give early warnings. Weather Services provides excellent early warning services, and we're really lucky actually as an African country to have such excellent services.
Guy, simply put, are you saying to me that an extreme event like Hurricane Beryl that the United States and the Caribbean is experiencing right now could provide useful lessons for the climate conditions in this part of the world?
Absolutely. A number of lessons, not only about the climate dynamics themselves, but also how society reacts and how infrastructure reacts. I think I've said before, the impact of wind doesn't rise in a linear way with the wind speed. It's exponential. It rises with the square of the wind speed. And understanding those issues and where those breakpoints occur is very, very important for city planning, building structures. All that is done by engineers, and so there's a sort of an interdisciplinary link here between climate science and engineering and town planning that has to start happening. We've got to start doing this joined up thinking, which is really one of the ideas behind our School for Climate Studies, is to bring all these ideas together.
I like that concept of joined up thinking. I'm wondering though whether the integration that you are suggesting is happening sufficiently and at enough speed.
I think I've seen it happening to a much larger extent here in our country, and I think there's some really, really good initiatives underway. Around the world, maybe less so. Some countries have far more sort of direct and immediate problems on their hands. But we, as a planet and as countries, we have to learn very, very fast about adapting to climate change. It's not going away. It's going to be with us for the rest of our lives, and certainly the lives of our kids and probably our grandkids. So the more we learn about it and the better we become prepared, the better off we're going to be. And the economic benefits of being prepared are vast, and the economic consequences of not being prepared are damaging in the extreme. We're starting to learn that very, very fast.
As far as the situation in Cape Town, and let me not be disingenuous, in your part of the world as well, I know the winelands have been adversely affected. If you were to extrapolate in the short to medium term, is there a good sense that this is going to continue for the rest of the year? Well, not continuously, but you could witness other events like this.
Well, I think these sorts of events are now with us. Look, this is the cutting edge of climate change. This is the way in which we start to really come to terms with climate change as a phenomenon. Up to a few years ago, it was much more of a theoretical issue, and now we're starting to see these impacts. We're in the age of consequences now, and that always concentrates and focuses the mind. So this is not going away. It's probably going to get worse in some ways. There will be cycles relating to things like El Nino and La Nina years. But on the whole, this is something that is going to worsen. And the faster we can stabilize and start to reduce carbon emissions, the sooner we will see the end of this tunnel. But at the moment, we can't see an end to this tunnel, I'm afraid to say.
It's interesting that you point out the importance of thinking along the lines of infrastructure improvement, better urban planning. But it's also very much a social issue. And by that, I mean community preparedness and community resilience. So in many ways, it's also, Guy, becoming a very political issue.
It is. It's a social issue. You know, we live in communities. We depend on one another. Individuals can make an enormous difference. Somebody just unblocking a drain can save a whole street from flooding, for example. And the sooner we realize that we have these codependencies, the better. I mean, I think many, many communities, we do. But the trick is now to convert sort of slightly more theoretical information about climate and weather into very, very practical actions that can be taken, so that people it becomes more like second nature as to how to react and how to support one another, how to help people recover from damaging events, and then also very importantly how to rebuild in ways that avoids future damage. So there's another massive area of engineering and planning that we require in the rebuilding of infrastructure to take advantage of a disaster, for example, to build better infrastructure that is more resilient. Enormously important that we learn fast from this.
And just quickly, this is not a facetious question. Do we need a Ministry of Climate Change?
Well, several countries do have them. Look, far be it from me to want to say we should add further ministries.
Or put your hand up, yeah.
But, you know, joined up thinking can sometimes, you know, take a back seat when things are too fragmented. But look, we have the Presidential Climate Commission and other bodies. We have the weather services. But I do think that the economic impacts are now so important that this cannot be just seen as an environmental issue. This is way beyond an environmental issue. This is an issue at the center of the sustainable development of South Africa and the region.
Always good talking to you, Professor Guy Midgley from the School for Climate Studies at Stellenbosch University.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
And let's finish the program with this. Adventure tourism is becoming a key attraction for travelers, and South Africa is standing out globally for its adventure offerings among the top competing destinations. All of that is good news. It's according to the South African Tourism's brand tracker. So let's find out how to improve on the situation and whether enough advantage is being taken of this niche market. Thembi Sehloho is the Chief Marketing Officer at South African Tourism on the program with me now. So firstly then, how has the popularity of adventure tourism in this country evolved in recent years? What factors do you think, Thembi, are contributing to its growth?
So what we are seeing from our research, because we obviously conduct research to understand why the tourists are coming to the country to do what. So against our competitors, what we are seeing is that, wildlife is one of the things we lead in. And the second thing we lead in is actually adventure tourism. And it's really predominantly driven by the landscapes that we have to offer and the scope. I mean, we have a variety of adventures that you can do in this country. So those are one of the key drivers. And I think the other key driver that we are seeing is that because we have the infrastructure, so sometimes people don't even come for adventure tourism. They'll be coming to town, and then the adventure tourism is so close and nearby that they then explore into it, or vice versa, where they come for adventure and then they end up doing other things within the vicinity. Because when you are in either Durban or Joburg or Cape Town, there's so much more to do outside of that. But it's one of those things that we are seeing taking growth because we have the products that offer, the best adventure in the world.
So when I think of tourism, or perhaps when an international visitor thinks tourism, they might think the Western Cape, Table Mountain, the Big Five. But I wonder if they are thinking sufficiently about adventure tourism and whether there isn't a deficit in terms of marketing this as a viable tourism opportunity.
I think there is definitely a deficit. Whilst we are seeing growth, this growth could be much bigger. I mean, it's only accounting for about 8.8% of the tourists that come to South Africa actually explore into adventure tourism. It is a trend that's growing internationally. So I think there's efforts that we are putting in now, being very intentional about driving it, especially in our key markets, which are Europe. So we are actually now going in and saying we need to advertise this properly and we need to be a little bit more focused. Because if you look at the spread, I mean, there's so much to do from this point. Whilst other people would take adventure tourism as when going to the Kruger Park, for some people that's adventure tourism. Mm. But I think we really just want to be intentional about driving those assets that are a true adventure, like shark cage diving in KZN, doing bungee jumping, which can be done in most of the provinces. But we have a spread of things that you can do within the space. I mean, hot air ballooning in Magaliesberg is also adventure tourism. But what we are doing as a team is really saying how do we package these things more intentionally. And what we're seeing as well is growth in plus 35s that are actually exploring into this. You know, we don't want people to see it as, it's young people that are wanting to do these things. But you're seeing 35 plus, you're seeing quite a growth of people who are interested in this. But to your point, if I had to answer you succinctly, not enough is being done. It's a huge opportunity for us, considering we have the products that support it. And we are now going to be a little bit more intentional about making sure that we package this and become the preferred choice in the world for adventure tourism.
Yeah, let's make no mistake. It's a very competitive market worldwide. Yeah. Are you able in any way to quantify the economic benefits of adventure tourism?
The economic benefits, we can quantify that. So if you look at a normal tourist versus an adventure tourist, a normal tourist will stay for like 9 days in the country. Because, you know, for economic benefits, it's very important that the tourists stay longer in the country. When you look at adventure tourism, they stay between 14 and 19 days. And they, for one tourist, they spend in excess of a minimum of 30,000 rands in their stay. So if you compound that in the numbers, the economic benefit becomes huge. So they are not the tourists that are here for a week and they're out. They stay a little bit longer because they go deeper into the bushes. They do more things when they're here. And the other economic benefit for me, I think, which I'm trying to link back from a socioeconomic value chain, is that some of these adventures are done in communities that are in rural, which are outside of towns and cities. So if we link that economic value chain, you start to then impact on those communities and, you know, drive rural tourism in that instance. But we have to intentionally kind of link the cycle as well to ensure that, you know, we account for that as well. And we're able to quantify and report back to say, you know, in these particular communities where we are driving the adventure tourism, this has been the economic impact in those communities. And you do the full cycle, because if people see the benefit, they support the initiatives and they protect the ecosystem of tourism, and we have a booming economy within tourism.
And just finally, it's critical, I imagine, to make sure that any activity is properly regulated and that the right measures of safety are in place.
Yeah, it is indeed. Whilst that is not really, it's not our mandate, but obviously we are critical in driving that conversation. So if you look at all, you know, the regulated, the, you know, the registered adventure tourism spaces in the country, they are well regulated, well managed. And I mean, as we grade, I mean, the, our involvement is that as we grade hotels, we also do grade this, we also do look at this establishment for safety. Whilst it's a different department, obviously, that deals with the safety of those establishments.
Thank you very much for joining me. That is Thembi Sihloho, Chief Marketing Officer at SA Tourism. And just before I say goodbye, on our online poll today, South Africa's auto industry, we spoke about it a little earlier in the program. Do you think it's on the ropes? Do you think it can recover? Or do you think we have too much choice as far as vehicles are concerned? If you have a view on that, I invite you to go to our X or LinkedIn page. That's also our program for today. MoneyWeb at Midday is live at noon weekdays. We are then up as a podcast. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.